listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Times of the Sign by Mark Seal. The grand houses rise, and the residents move in, soon to include actors Humphrey Bogart and Bela Lugosi, the mobster Bugsy Siegel, and business leaders and titans of all stripes. 9 years later, on the night of September 16, 1932, an out-of-work actor will shatter the peace and quiet so dear to Hollywoodland. Her name is Millicent Lillian Entwistle, but she goes by Peg. She is 24, with a flapper's hairdo and a solid stage resume, having appeared opposite the young Bogart. An 18-year-old Betty Davis is said to have told her mother, "I want to be exactly like Peg Entwistle." Now, though, Entwistle is divorced and depressed, either over her lying cad of an ex-husband, who deceived her by not revealing his previous marriage and child, or her struggle to replicate her success on the New York stage in the movie business. Her few months in town have been rocky. Acting jobs lost or abandoned, movie scenes cut by the National Board of Review, housing troubles, and compounding the indignities, financial woes so deep that she is forced to move in with her Uncle Charles and Aunt Jane at 2434 North Beechwood Drive in Hollywoodland. She tells them she is going to buy a book at the village drugstore. Instead, she may well have walked up Beechwood Drive on the route you are traversing now, past the cute little gingerbread Hollywoodland real estate office, near the house Clark Gable once shared with Carol Lombard, and on to the now forbidden trails leading to the sign. No one will remember seeing her, not hikers or pedestrians, nor residents, not even Koth, the light bulb changer. She borrows his ladder to climb up to the H, then takes her final bow before the City of Angels, leaping from the letter and rolling down the hillside to her death. 2 days later, a woman calls the LAPD. She says she's found a jacket, a purse, and shoes beneath the Hollywood sign. Then she hangs up, but not before saying she's left the items on the steps outside the Hollywood station. Inside the purse is a note. "I'm afraid I am a coward. I am sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain." Headlines blaze. "Actress ends life by jumping off sign after failure in movies," read the New York Times. "Suicide laid to film jinx," adds an L.A. newspaper. It's difficult to separate truth from myth. Did she leap or fall? What was her motivation, considering her prospects for film roles were improving? Legend has it that the very next day a letter arrived in her uncle's mailbox, offering her a role in a play about a woman driven to suicide, says Wright. However her life ended, Entwistle is elevated in death from tortured actor to legend. The cautionary tale, as Ryan Murphy, who will make a pilgrimage to the Hollywood sign shortly after moving to L.A. in the late 80s, tells OprahMag.com. "There were tours where they would show you which letter she jumped off and how she did it," he'll recall. The second episode of the Netflix series Hollywood, co-created by Murphy, will show Darren Criss, Jeremy Pope, Laura Harrier, David Corenswet, and Samara Weaving climbing the sign, the ultimate metaphor for acting's ladder of success. Entwistle becomes known as the Hollywood Sign Girl, a ghostly symbol of all Hollywood's failures. Her favorite scent, gardenia, is said to waft on the evening breeze. Maybe she even cursed the sign. By 1939, 7 years after her death, The sign is a ragged wreck. Most of Hollywoodland's lots have sold, and maintenance of the sign has stopped. A torrential rainstorm demolishes the H from which Entwistle leapt. It's supposed to be temporary, a billboard, just sheet metal, and so it gets ripped up, says Browdy. The Recreation and Parks Department considers it a public nuisance and wants to tear the whole thing down. In April 1949, the sign's first savior, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, steps up as caretaker. The word land is excised and restoration begins. The sign will now become a billboard, not merely for homes, but for dreams. It reads simply Hollywood. As the years pass, the sign moves from supporting to starring roles in movies, television, and eventually social media. Maybe you saw it in the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, hovering over the young Will Smith as he whistles for a taxi to take him home to his new home in Southern California. Or in season 4 of Seinfeld, mocking Kramer's dreams of fame and fortune after he travels to L.A. and ends up being wrongfully arrested for murder. Or in Quentin Tarantino's comic noir Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, taunting a washed-up television actor, Leonardo DiCaprio, and his stunt double, Brad Pitt, as they try to make sense of the late 60s. The sign beckons as a backdrop for Love and Lust. In Friends with Benefits, Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake traverse the sacred ground behind the sign, then sit together on the first O until a cop in a helicopter orders them to get down. In the teen romance, The Kissing Booth, late bloomer L, Joey King, and bad boy Noah, Jacob Elordi, lie naked on the hillside near the sign as the camera sweeps across the magical letters. Directors love to destroy the sign, perhaps in subconscious revenge for their early struggles here. In the disaster movie San Andreas, a monster earthquake levels the Los Angeles landscape, bringing the sign tumbling down. Such a downfall seems unlikely, though, for the sign is eternal, indestructible, forever in the sky and the minds of those inspired by it. Just find the hills, we were told, and you'll know where you are, says Stephen Gyllenhaal, the filmmaker and author who drove out to Los Angeles in the summer of 1978 at age 29. No money, no prospects, except hope, which was echoed by the sign. He and his first wife, the screenwriter Naomi Foner, pull into town with their 8-month-old baby, the future actor-director Maggie Gyllenhaal, in the back seat. Their son, the actor Jake Gyllenhaal, will arrive 2 years later. They move into a small house just south of Melrose, almost directly below the sign, he says. After all these years, Gyllenhaal is still transfixed by the sign's contradictions. Sure, there's the Eiffel Tower, the pyramids, Mount Kilimanjaro, the Great Wall of China. But we have our Hollywood sign perched precariously on top of hills that too often catch fire, marketing the magic of storytelling, he says. 9 letters, silly, romantic, tenacious, hopeful, and almost dignified, but not quite. The perfect monument for the place that I proudly call home. For me, it was always the welcome signpost I returned to when I wrapped a film. Home, says 2-time Academy Award winner Jodie Foster, who attended an elementary school directly beneath the sign. The movie business has been my family since I was 3 years old. I've never known anything else. When I park my car off Beechwood and take the palm-lined hike up to the fire trail behind the sign, I'm back in the 70s. Back to the Polaroid color of my childhood nostalgia, familiar and bittersweet, just like the sign. Bobby Chance is 18 years old the first time she sees the sign. It's the mid-60s, and she has just arrived from Miami with a 7-year studio contract that will lead to roles in Pajama Party, Beach Blanket Bingo, and other swinging beach flicks. She falls in love with the letters at first sight, and the sign becomes her lucky North Star, spurring her not only to make it in Hollywood, but to inspire others. She becomes a Hollywood acting coach, goading and guiding a multitude of wannabes in hopes of unleashing their potential. That sign stands for dreams, she sighs in her Valley Village home office, whose walls are lined with pictures of celebrities who she says passed through or visited her Hollywood actor showcase. Brad Pitt, Jennifer Aniston, Martin Lawrence, Kardashians, and dozens more. You gotta come here with a dream. You can't touch the sign and you can't touch the dream, but it's always there. She looks skyward as if staring up at those nine letters on the hill. It's not at eye level. It's always looking down at you and saying, get your shit together or go home to mama. That sign is in your face all the time. And yes, she acknowledges, the whole thing is a sham. What is Hollywood? It's a bunch of motels, hotels, and tourist shops. People from all over the world come to Hollywood, thinking they are going to see Scarlett Johansson walking down the street. The whole thing is bullshit. Hollywood is a storefront window with no store. There is no Hollywood. Hollywood only happens when you succeed. But that sign is real. That sign is a global magnetic force for dreamers from all over the world. It's as universal as the Apple logo or the Nike swoosh. The ultimate global symbol of everything these young kids want. Fame, fortune, and the keys to a Malibu beach house. Elegance Bratton, the filmmaker, writer, and producer, making his narrative fiction debut this year with his semi-autobiographical film The Inspection, first sees the sign in 2009. Then a Marine corporal visiting a friend at Camp Pendleton in San Diego, he feels the sign calling to him from afar. We can't be this close to Los Angeles without seeing the Hollywood sign, he tells his friend. So they jump into her car and drive 3 hours to Beechwood Canyon. Staring up at the letters, Bratton imagines Marilyn Monroe, Sidney Poitier, Madonna, and so many other icons looking at this concrete, tangible, touchable symbol of Hollywood. He has to get closer. A combat filmmaker, accustomed to rocky terrain, he begins the long climb, evading everything to reach the summit. And here, he reaches out and actually makes contact with the letters, feeling their power. I was just blown away. All I could think about is, how many people who aspired to be in the industry made the same track that I did? 8 years after actually touching the sign and realizing what's possible, he releases his first short film, Walk For Me. Today, he lives in Beechwood Canyon, right beneath the landmark where it all began. It's like when people go to Mecca, or the Vatican to look at the Virgin Mary, or the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa. Being able to climb up there was an influential experience for me. Next photo, King of the Hill. In 1978, Playboy impresario Hugh Hefner teamed up with actors Vivian Blaine and Rita Hayworth, among others, on a $250,000 effort to save the then-dilapidated sign. For some, getting too close to the sign is like getting too close to the sun. When we were in our backyard, we looked up at this behemoth, says the director and artist Aaron Rose, who lived for 5 tortured years in a mid-century modern house hanging off a cliff directly beneath a sign. It was challenging, one of the largest tourist destinations on the West Coast, but no infrastructure. Strangers walking onto the property to get a photo. Once our security camera caught 3 girls in a convertible yellow Mustang who pulled into our driveway, took their tops off, and posed in front of the sign. Sometimes he would stare up at it and ask, "Are you my friend or are you my adversary?" As a director, he was in and out of work. When things were going well, the sign seemed to be smiling down on him. like fate had placed me in that house at the foot of that monument of Hollywood success. And I loved it, he says. But when he was between jobs, the sign bore down upon him with an unrelenting glare. It took on a human, almost like a godlike personality. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and sit at the outdoor table in my underwear and stare at it. I would say, "You effing bitch." It was like what Dennis Hopper said in Blue Velvet. "Don't look at me. Don't you effing look at me." He often felt the presence of Peg Entwistle. Maybe they're not jumping off the sign anymore, but that sign still represents all the darkness and sadness that this town has imparted on young, impressionable people. I would look at the sign at 2 a.m. and think about all of the broken dreams. Now you are almost there, riding up the circuitous route, the sign peeking at you around every turn. You think about all of the greats who have gazed upon it, an unfathomable array of talent and tenaciousness, producing and performing in the sign's looming shadow. You remember the icons, as humbled by the sign as the newcomers. In the Baz Luhrmann biopic Elvis, Austin Butler, playing the king, lounges, lip curled and determined for a comeback, in the rusty, tattered O of the 1970 sign, telling his crew, "When I first came to Hollywood, I'd come up here and sit for hours. The sign was beautiful then, and now feels as though lots of things are like that these days, broke down, beat up, rotten." In 1978, with the sign once again on the brink of destruction, another savior rose up, Hugh Hefner, the priapic founder of Playboy magazine, an authority on the power of symbols, having turned a drawing of a bow-tied bunny into a globally recognized logo. Hefner spearheaded a $250,000 campaign to save the sign. The amount was oddly equivalent in terms of inflation to the $21,000 the sign originally cost, says Leo Browdy. But it's enough for a renovation so thorough and successful that an engineer will say that'll be there when the mountain leaves. It's there for good. And now you are there, too, ready at last to see the sign up close. You pass through the fabled gate, whose name you are forbidden to reveal. Once opened, it allows you to access a private road at the top of Mount Lee, where you and Diana Wright will traverse the rocky terrain straight down to the sign. She hands you a rope. "We're going to rappel down to the letters together," she says, holding out the rope for you to grasp as you go slipping and sliding down the steep hillside. At last you are there, standing amid the letters, reaching out to actually touch them. But from this vantage point, they are too big, too close, mammoth walls of blinding, indecipherable white. Like a movie screen, the sign is best seen from a distance, prettier from far away, fairly ordinary up close, says Jodie Foster. You cast a nervous glance at the terrain below. It's a very long way down, but you have made it to the summit, and like every other fresh-off-the-highway interloper with the audacity to believe you belong here, you want that photo. "Sunglasses or no?" you ask the keeper of the sign. "It's Hollywood," she replies. "Sunglasses." So you put on your sunglasses and you smile. Will the sign smile back at you, miraculously replacing your vagabond clothes with Oscar gowns and acceptance speech tuxedos? Or will it curse you, standing in smug but silent witness as you are cast to the hinterlands? Whatever your fate, the sign will still be there, blessing the town's winners, mocking its failures, and beckoning a never-ending parade of aspirants with the power of a single word. west of Eden. Out of the fringe right, a new vision of the old frontier is rising. Off the grid, back to the land, protecting an American dream that they believe to be their own, by James Pogue. Opening illustration by Brian Stauffer, which shows armed cowboys on horses riding toward modern-day cars, along with charging buffalo. The buffalo were grazing by the highway on the outskirts of the richest county in the richest country in the history of the world. It was a clear morning in the Tetons, and with binoculars it was possible to see all the way across the valley known, since prehistory, as one of the most secure and comfortable little basins in all of the Mountain West, named for one of the first white trappers to winter there, Jackson's Hole. The landscape may have looked like wilderness to the caravanning tourist in $200,000 Sprinter vans, and thousands more in athleisure who now flood Teton County year-round. But it is also a kind of hyper-reality of money, tens of thousands of acres and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of conservation easements, in what may be the world's most unequal political jurisdiction. Above the ospreys and eagles, there was a constant traffic of small jets and private aircraft, humming into and out of a town that has become a modern refuge for people with remote jobs and portfolios, fattened by one of history's great asset bubbles. Many of them driven to the northern Rockies by a worry or wariness that the rest of America is on its way toward environmental, political, or economic breakdown, or some combination of the above. A couple hours outside Jackson, I met Catherine O'Neill, whose family once owned these mountains. Her great-great-grandfather was John D. Rockefeller, and she worked in Trump's State Department. Now she was living in a modest little house outside of Casper, Wyoming, and was about to have her first child with a home appraiser she'd met after moving there. She isn't hiding out exactly, but like many Americans these days, she has a sense that things are cracking up. Election night we were talking, kind of joking, she said. At the time she was living in D.C., I was afraid of being thrown into a concentration camp. I know that sounds crazy. I was with my friends, and I was like, well, we're kind of effed, she said. And they're like, well, let's choose a red state to go take over. And I was like, well, I have a place in Wyoming we can go. She is a proud conservative who views the corporate elite as enemies of America and believes that we're on the cusp of a populist uprising against the brand of transnational capitalism championed by Republicans for most of the last half century. Her politics have marked her, at least to the minds of people who share her worldview, as a bit of a class traitor in their emergent epochal struggle against the entire system. Maybe I'm biased, obviously, she said, but if these organizations were run by people like my grandfather, he was a devout Christian and actually cared about this country and wanted to build this country up. That would be one thing. He literally led the way for this country to be a superpower, she said, and we have seen a 180 now. That's what's interesting with a lot of these executives. They're now trying to, it seems to me, break the country down. O'Neill was the key to understanding all this, according to the former Trump staffer who put us in touch. Not because she necessarily possessed any secret knowledge, but because she captured so many of the quiet currents swirling around younger conservative circles these days. Wealthy and well-connected preppers and back-to-the-landers have been moving west, many of them at least tangentially involved in the edgy online realm of thought known as the dissident right. Tech executives and crypto investors are creating secretive groups to help people exit, a term that has taken on almost mystical significance in some circles recently, from our liberal society, tech-dominated lives, and fraying system. and there are grander plans for whole secessionist movements using crypto and decentralized autonomous organizations to build whole mini-societies, many on the model of what Balaji Srinivasan, the former partner at Andreessen Horowitz, calls a network state. Wyoming recently became the first state in the country to allow DAOs to incorporate as private companies. These ideas used to be at the fringiest fringe of a worldview that sees our basic political battle lines shifting from left-right divisions toward a rebellion against globalization, against the notion that the massive market and tech-driven change that we've been living through really represents progress. But this dissident fringe view has rapidly become mainstream on the right, in part through the dire warnings of a disintegrating global system shared almost nightly on Tucker Carlson Tonight, and significantly through coded signifiers broadcast by Republican politicians trying to capitalize on the populist ferment. Most obviously Ron DeSantis, who gave a speech titled Florida versus Davos to the National Conservatism Conference last September. The United States is a nation that has an economy, not the other way around, he said, and our economy should be geared toward helping our own people. According to this view, the American empire is in danger of fading, weakened by a greedy and insulated oligarchy with more loyalty to their pals in London and Tokyo than to their fellow Americans. The elite have driven regular people into a serf-like existence, putting money above every other source of value or meaning, national interest, local cultures, our long-term financial stability, even the environment. Many young conservatives have suddenly adopted an almost mystical reverence for nature, itself a form of protest against our money and tech-driven world. The result is that now a lot of highly online coastal elites talk in much the same way that backwoods militiamen arming themselves against the New World Order have been for decades, and vice versa. Just before I left for Wyoming, a Substack post by a writer who tweets under the name Disgraced Propagandist, titled There's Gonna Be a War in Montana, went viral. A dozen acquaintances sent it to me, including my editor at Vanity Fair. The writer explicitly linked the anti-globalist analysis to an anger that's been swirling in the American West over the land rush engendered by well-off coastal buyers, which has sent rents and home prices spaceward, forcing people to move away or become homeless. Longtime locals talk about being colonized by a flood of rich liberal newcomers. On one side, you have global interest imputing their values, importing cheaper labor, hollowing out Montana's attractions, and selling them to an international bourgeoisie for maximum profits, went the post. On the other side, you have the new underclass, not the friendly Christian country folk of times past, and not cowboy hat Republican rancher dad either. No, these are a new kind of country person, angry, exasperated, poor, he wrote. This group is acutely aware of just who controls Bozeman and Big Sky, and believe that the same people are coming for their territory, and they're right. The Montana-based novelist Walter Kern, who has become a hero in dissident circles, called it immaculate bullshit, and suggested it had been written by someone hoping to inflame liberal fears of rural revolt. But it captured a moment. It was the same moment in which Liz Cheney, Wyoming's lone congressional representative, found herself losing her primary race in an election in which her opponents cast her as an almost perfect expression of the kind of elite oligarch with no true local roots or state loyalty. I arrived in Wyoming just in time to attend her concession party. Cheney's father looked on, tight-lipped, standing next to a carefully placed hay bale at stage left, as she conceded at twilight, among a small crowd of whale-heeled supporters dressed in Haute Western finery. She, too, talked openly about civil war, a possibility that more than 40% of Americans still think is likely, even after the midterms produced an outcome that made our politics look surprisingly normal by the eerie standards of today. "This is not a game," she said. "Our nation is barreling once again towards crisis, lawlessness, and violence. America is young in the history of mankind," she said, "and yet we're the oldest democracy in the world. Our survival is not guaranteed." A big mustachioed oil man named Tex McBride, who ran a pro-Cheney super PAC, was watching from the back of the crowd. I asked him what he thought was coming next for America. "My answer's not fit for the record," he said, but he went on anyway. "I think we're effed." The so-called dissident right is a world of thought where categories get scrambled. It shares space with the more buttoned-up politics of the new right, but these days includes a whole range of unlikely allies. The scene, as everyone calls it, is a small, cliquey, and status-obsessed world where even at parties, people often call each other by their Twitter handles. Extremely wealthy tech types chat on Signal all day with hustling writers and smugly racist bodybuilders and rationalist sex workers, and the simple truth is that many people tend to think America, as we once knew it, is already pretty much gone. "Who even needs a civil war?" one scene fixture texted me recently, "when the institutions are doing such a good job of delegitimizing themselves." This scene was very much on display in Austin, where in July last, I went to see the premiere of Alex's War, a documentary about Alex Jones. The night before the screening, Futo, a software company started by a founding investor of WhatsApp and dedicated to fighting tech oligopoly, hosted a swank cocktail party on the roof of the downtown Marriott. Curtis Yarvin, the intellectual godfather of the dissident right and popularizer of the idea that America is not and should not be a functioning democracy, flew in for the screening the next day. In front of him was the former Trump staffer and documentarian Amanda Milius, who was wearing an elaborate white dress and showing off her serpentine Bulgari bangles with emeralds for eyes. In front of her was Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, who had, along with Jones himself, helped put on the rally that devolved into the Capitol invasion. Ariel Pink, the chillwave musician, who was an indie kingpin before it got out that he'd been at the January 6th rally, he left before anyone breached the Capitol, was there too. So were Mike Cernovich and Anna Kachian, the co-host of the formerly left-wing podcast Red Scare. Glenn Greenwald hosted the question and answer session with Jones and Alex Lee Moyer, the film's director. Greenwald looked out at the room, beaming, and described the gathering as a merry band of misfits, charter members of a disaffected counterculture. "We're a bunch of weirdos and rebels here," he said, "and I just love that." Jones himself had been visibly upset throughout the screening, getting up half a dozen times from his front row seat to escape backstage. "I couldn't watch myself through some of that," he said during the Q&A. "I looked like Jabba the Hutt on PCP. He kept apologizing for his conspiracy theories about the Sandy Hook killings, without seeming to want to actually say that he was apologizing. "A lot of that stuff I say," he went on, "it's like I drank a bottle of vodka. I'm smoking cigarettes and you're just talking. I don't know what the hell I'm going to say." At the after party at another swank Austin hotel, he grinned next to a cart of champagne bottles and posed for photos with well-dressed young fans. There's a story that Jones has been telling these last 30 years as he rose from a local curiosity on public access television to someone who claimed, by the time of the 2016 election, to be pulling in more unique viewers than every cable news network in America combined. and it has risen from the sort of thing that only kooks and rural militiamen talked about to become the grand narrative at hand. I don't know who is going to be in the White House on January 20th, 2021, he'd said, hours before the January 6th rally he helped organize, but I do know that Joe Biden is a globalist. Resistance to globalism is a new organizing force of right-wing politics. These people at the World Economic Forum, DeSantis told the National Conservatism Conference last September, they just view us as a bunch of peasants. I can tell you things like the World Economic Forum are dead on arrival in the state of Florida. It could have been Alex Jones talking. If you believe this story, marking yourself as a nationalist, as many Republican politicians now call themselves, or a localist, as the American Conservative, house organ of the anti-globalist right, proudly describes itself, this framing explains why our society seems to be spinning apart. The relentless power of markets has worked its way into every part of our lives, breaking down traditional cultures and modes of life, forcing us to live drone-like lives ordered by our phones and credit scores, leading to the mass export of jobs overseas, the destruction of the natural world, an internationalist foreign policy that cost trillions of dollars and thousands of lives, and even the destruction of institutions like the American family farm. It is, like Marxism was once for the global left, a story that is a Bible to all the other stories you need to understand the world. This politics is already reshaping Europe, where Vladimir Putin has made it clear that the invasion of Ukraine was intended to be a first step in smashing what you'll hear sneeringly called the globo-homo, a term spiced with homophobia, used both in Russia and on the American right to describe a world transforming into a soulless landscape of chain stores and empty hedonism. Just after Giorgia Meloni and her right-wing coalition won elections in Italy last September, a video ricocheted around the spheres of the dissident right and the social media feeds of some highly placed Republicans. In it, Meloni says, "When I am only a number, when I no longer have an identity or roots, then I will be the perfect slave at the mercy of financial speculators, the perfect consumer." But it's not just the right. Even figures in the Democratic Party seem to be coming to the conclusion that globalization presents a deeper problem than anyone wants to talk about during our overheated elections. President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, has been on a subtle journey of discovery, talking about how our headlong rush into globalization may have been misguided. In November, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy published a piece in The Atlantic titled "The Wreckage of Neoliberalism," using a phrase that, on the left, critiques much the same system. By accentuating a pro-family platform of economic nationalism, salted with a bit of healthy tech skepticism, he wrote, Democrats can build a new coalition that sells in the parts of our society that have suffered under and grown tired of the neoliberal consensus. Last November, the Wall Street Journal ran a slideshow describing the messy unwinding of the New World Order, depicting a pullback in international investment since the high times before the 2008 financial crash. New World Order was once famously uttered by President George H.W. Bush, and it described a system built on the expectation of more or less constant economic growth, American military power, a stabilizing force, and ceaseless technological development to allow the world to pay for the cost of building it and the massive increase in global population. It's a kind of gigantic pyramid scheme we all participate in, a constant revolution, as the Israeli journalist Nadav Eyal described it in Revolt, his best-selling account of the anti-globalization backlash. Our constant revolution and the response to it was on full display at the Corral Bar on West Pine in Pinedale, Wyoming. Town motto, all the civilization you need. You can still smoke inside, and the night I was there, most of the clientele was sunburned and foul-mouthed fly fishing guides with endless ribald anecdotes about the private jet types they cater to. A sticker above the bar reads, "My Wyoming has an yeast infection." I want to put the blinders on, but you know what? It's going to happen, a richly tattooed grandmother named Catherine told me. "It's happening everywhere," she said, just before she burst into tears, as she talked about how she no longer had any hope of being able to buy a house to live in with her daughter. Too many other people were looking for a small-town feel, space to roam and be in nature, a life that felt calm and sane. They don't want to be in the cities anymore, and I don't blame them. She said she'd gotten into an argument with some investors from Atlanta just a few days before. I said to them, "You're going to have to make housing for people who are going to wipe your asses," she said. "Everybody deserves to choose where they want to live. But people that are in the elite, in their heads, they don't think that." When did that happen? I had versions of this conversation dozens of times over the next few weeks. "The only fix to what is happening right now," a man from tiny Augusta, Montana, told me, "is going to be if we drag that real estate agent who is selling away the soul of this community down Main Street with a chain." I stopped to fish off the Green River between Pinedale and Jackson Hole and ended up chatting with a mother and her adult son who were living out of a camper, having been priced out of rural California. "What's going to happen when there's nowhere left affordable to go?" the mom asked. "There's going to be a war," the son said casually. I'd been invited to the annual Jackson Hole Land Trust picnic, billed to me as the most glamorous picnic on earth. It was held 80 miles and a world away from Pinedale, on a ranch just south of Jackson, where guests had to nose their vehicles through a small herd of cattle blocking the dirt access road to get to the field tents serving local meats, whiskeys, and wines. The Land Trust is at the center of the local philanthropic scene. It has secured conservation easements, preventing development on 55,000 acres of private land in a county where the federal government already owns 97% of it. This has been very good for the surrounding ecosystems and very good for the private jet class, who save millions in federal income tax. Wealthy people out here tend to do conservation easements as a financial tactic, as one land trust expert put it to Justin Farrell, the author of the book Billionaire Wilderness. At least one member of this class of new Rockefellers has made a sport of it, flying a helicopter each summer to scout a new parcel to buy. Meanwhile, the town has an underclass of service workers, largely Latino, with little but cramped and irregular housing, a pattern now common in wealthy towns in the West and across the country. In Ketchum, Idaho, the town council recently considered legalizing camping in the city park, which would have created a government-sanctioned shanty town for service workers who can't afford to live where they work. The crowd at the picnic had the same turquoise jewelry, big hats, and effortfully folksy manner that colors Western high society in every town from Santa Fe to Sun Valley. Everyone I spoke to was uncomfortably conscious of what the town had come to symbolize, a place for an elite to play act at rugged Americana. The average home price in the county is now $4 million, and the median income is $420,000. Sean Smith, the absurdly handsome chairman of the Land Trust board and the founder of an environmentally minded hedge fund, said, "I didn't come to Jackson to change Jackson. I fish, I hunt, I recreate. My wife works for a nonprofit," he said. "So I see that and wonder how it's changing." He was a Republican and a Brown graduate. "The wealthiest people in town used to drive around in pickups and Suburbans," he said, "which has changed, judging by the cars parked in the field. But if you look at anywhere in the U.S., the socioeconomic structure is changing, and I think it's easy to look at the West as a microcosm of that." The whole system is rapidly unraveling, town council member Jonathan Schechter had told me after he'd given a panoramic environmental, political, and economic analysis of what had made Jackson into an extreme example of what was off in all of America. It was strange to hear, coming from a small-town city councilman, but these are strange times. 80% of the personal income in the county comes from investment proceeds, which is another way of saying that it is money derived from having money. He described how a location-neutral economy dominated by a small elite had transformed a place that, until recently, had still been remote enough to retain a cross-class community character. These people are getting paid a ton of money. They can get whatever services they want online, and they can have all these bodacious ski hills, he told me. And so you get all these people who are like, okay, great, we'll buy up a pool of homes and jack up the rent, and it's just become another money pot to them. The process is unfolding across the expanse of the greater Yellowstone region, the closest thing to a large intact ecosystem left in the lower 48 states, which encompasses towns like Bozeman and Livingston, Montana, both undergoing their own upheavals. No one talked about any of this during Cheney's primary, the highest-profile election Wyoming has ever seen. What makes it sad is that candidates who want to run in Wyoming are preening and dancing for outside billionaires instead of addressing what people are actually worried about, a longtime Wyoming politico named Rob Jennings told me. Everyone in Wyoming becomes almost like a subject or a service worker, he said. You're turning it into a service worker economy, and the only people who get heard are the political interest, the oil interest, the billionaire interest. A few years ago, Steve Bannon had a coffee date with Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage. If you're interested, and I'll fund it somehow, Bannon told his English counterpart while a documentarian filmed, we'll help knit together this populist nationalist movement throughout the world. Guys in Egypt are coming to me, Bannon said. Modi's guys in India, Duterte, we get, Orban, he said, referring to the then president of the Philippines and the current nationalist prime minister of Hungary, respectively. He wanted to create, somehow, some sort of convening authority for conferences and stuff like that, so we can get ideas like that out there. Nobody's doing it right now. Nobody's doing it, Farage said, as he nodded along, seeming to have trouble getting a word in. It's a global revolt, Bannon said. It's a zeitgeist. We're on the right side of history. But it's going to need the motive power. The ideas have to come in more sharp focus. The economic ideas, the political ideas, right? I'd been hoping to meet with Bannon when I left Jackson to link up with O'Neill, the Rockefeller farmer. She had told me that both Bannon and David Bossie, the head of Citizens United, were coming to town for a movie night hosted by the state Republican Party, which had been taken over by a diehard Trump faction led by a man named Frank Athorn, who was reportedly at the Capitol on January 6th and who revved up crowds by saying he'd run through barbed wire for Trump. The bitter congressional primary had passed, but there were still strange machinations at work. Jennings had wondered aloud how the state party had been taken over by people who carry clubs and knives, members of the Oath Keepers, crap like that. He suspected national forces were at work. He doesn't even have a base. Nobody even effing knows the guy. O'Neill was friendly with Bannon, who had tried to persuade her to run against Cheney. I was sitting in Steve Bannon's house January 12th, she said. He told her, you have to run. You have to beat her. You're going to be Trump's girl, she said. I was sitting there like, I don't really want to take on this duty. That's not really where I actually am. She laughed and said she was thinking, I'm about to be picked up in a helicopter and shipped off to Guantanamo Bay. I am so torn, she said after a while. Her baby was due in a couple of weeks, and we'd been talking about her family, about Wyoming, about the 580-acre vertically integrated cattle operation she'd started, tiny by Wyoming standards, but one she had high hopes for as a test of new farming methods. She said she'd been watching documentaries about her family online, thinking about the irony of a Rockefeller who'd adopted a politics that was supposed to be about reducing the power of money and corporations over our lives. "I try to be very self-aware," she said. "I can't pretend I'm not who I am, so it's been a very interesting struggle for me." She seemed caught between the desire to live a simple life away from it all and the desire to be a part of the world shaping changes that people like her and Bannon believe are coming. Food politics is her way of trying to split the difference. "We don't have that stability anymore," she said, talking about disruptions to supply chains and a general sense that systems we once never had to think about were breaking down. "And that's terrifying." "Look at Italy's election," she said to me later. "That was a direct rejection of internationalism, globalism, whatever you want to call it." She told me that her dream president was Thomas Massie, the Republican Kentucky congressman who lives on a 1,200-acre off-grid homestead and who combines a quixotic critique of America's involvement overseas with a hyper-localist platform. "Giving Americans the right to control their own food and sustenance, I mean, it's at the core of that fight." We ended up at the bar with her fiancé and some of her friends, among them a carpenter, a schoolteacher, regular people. It was slightly surreal to drink beer and to jump between talking about running irrigation pipe to hearing her anecdotes about how funny Nigel Farage is in person. The next morning, I drove up to her small house on a plot a few miles up Casper Mountain. "I don't even think there is a working-class party right now," she said. "The Democrats have abandoned them. The Republicans aren't there yet." She was undecided about Ron DeSantis. The one unabashed champion of her kind of politics on a national stage is Tucker Carlson. "If Tucker announced his presidency tomorrow," she said, "I would literally move to D.C., 9 months pregnant, to go work for him." I asked if she thought he would ever run. "I think he will get to a point where he feels like he has to," she said. But her vision of the good life was so different from anything anyone talks about on a national stage that it's hard to know whether it is even a politics at all. It used to be, you have a few acres, you work the land, you raise a family, your kids help you garden, till, or whatever, she said, describing a world she thought had been wrecked by regulations and the oligopoly of corporations like Monsanto. "And then you create enough food for your family and maybe your community." I said it must be strange to desire a life like that, being a Rockefeller and all. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.